You're listening to Trot the Egging, hosted by John Hetherington, working with Widnes Rugby Union Football Club, sponsored by Boydells.
This week's rugby story is a Camden-born journalist who grew up loving sport, particularly football and cricket. Finding herself throughout school led to our guest heading for Warwick Uni. Leaving uni still unsure of what she wanted to do led her to try broadcast journalism at City Uni. Safe to say she threw herself into everything she could, covering anything to gain valuable experience in the journalism world. Radio and telly is where we'll all know her from best, and doing a stellar job at it. Ladies and gents, Mrs. Tanya Arnold.
Follow, like, share, subscribe and endorse us via Facebook, Trot the Egging, Twitter, @TrotTheEgging/@JohnHeth, Instagram, @Trot_D_Egg_In, YouTube, Trot the Egging, LinkedIn, John Hetherington, and Spotify, Trot the Egging.
So, Tanya, how have you been?
Good. Very, very different. Having, you know, come out of a job, I was at BBC Yorkshire in one form or another for nigh on 30 years. So it's been a very strange few weeks getting used to life without structure, but it's good. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it's a long time to get comfy and settled. Sometimes a change is a scary thought, but something exciting.
Yeah, I think it felt right. It still feels right. It's life without structure is very strange. You know, I was used to either going to the office for the morning since COVID, being on a Zoom call at X time in the morning, then going off and doing what you were going to do. And on the odd occasion, I wasn't doing a story, you know, grafting to set up a load of others. So it's quite weird just sort of unknitting that kind of structure, but also just trying to make new contacts, network in a world that I don't know and haven't been in, which is the sort of business scene. But I have to say, people have been incredibly helpful, very welcoming, and I've had some really interesting conversations with people. So it's been nice. Just need to get some work now.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? So before we get stuck into your story, where was home for you as a kid and who lived at home with you?
London. So I'm born and bred in Camden Town. Mum, dad and sister. Sister 5.5 years older than me, so kind of disappeared off in my teenage years. But yeah, I'm a North London lass.
Right. And what was school life like in London, and what was on offer for you as a kid at school?
So I went through the local primary school, the local state school, was actually at school with Edwin Miliband for quite a long time. I actually did a piece with him we obviously announced beforehand that, you know, I knew him as a kid, but did because he's a Doncaster MP, which was quite amusing to do. But it was good fun. I was a tomboy, which I don't think would surprise anybody. I was a grafter, which I think I still am. You know, I didn't cause anybody any trouble. But sport wise, I did whatever I could, an awful lot of playing cricket and football in the school playground with the other kids, until a girl couldn't really do that. And therein lies a tale, I guess.
Right. So how did you find the transition from junior school to high school then, with being, as you said, a tomboy? Was it difficult or did you find it pretty easy?
I'm not sure I was that aware of it, if that makes sense, in that, yeah, you know, quite a lot of the kids, at least, we all moved together, which I think makes things easier. It was a huge school I went to, the secondary school. It was kind of, you get a real mix in Camden Town of, you know, in bits of it, it's quite wealthy and middle class, other bits of it quite run down. And particularly back then, there was some, you know, quite interesting mix of kids. And the inter-school fights were quite interesting. Those trips home from school were, you had to dodge them. But I think I've always been somebody who sort of kept their head down and just tried to stay out of trouble. So I think that's what I was like. And I think in terms of growing up into a woman, I think that took quite a long time. My mum's probably, you'd describe her as a bit of a tomboy as well. So I think that journey took a little bit longer for me than it might have for others.
Right. And do you think with your knowledge and ability to play sport made it a bit easier with several friendship groups?
No,
was
I think it made
to
it
float around.
No, I don't think so, because I was a tomboy, so and girls didn't play football and cricket, which I loved playing in the playground afterwards. So I think I was probably a bit of an odd one out. I didn't have a huge friendship group, but it's one of those that I've got my best friend is latterly from sixth form, and I've got some really, really good friends from that time. I think I was finding my way in the early years. But no, I don't think sport didn't help me, because I was very much an odd one out, because I was the only girl.
Yeah, how much of a shame that is when you see where sport's gone now, yeah, and where it is going.
Yeah, I always say I might have been an international cricketer. You never know. I can dream. Nobody will know the difference now. I think, well, God, blimey, if I tried to bowl now, I think bits of me would fall off.
So, well, you've been around people where it has, so I think you've got a bit of a wise decision there, yeah, aren't you, just to look after yourself. So with school being tricky then, was school something you really got stuck into? Because a lot of people I speak to, it was used mainly for social.
Yeah, I mean, I switched schools when I was 13, because my parents moved down to Kent. I found myself in an all-girls school, which was very odd for me, because, I say, I'd been a right tomboy, wasn't a girly girl at all. Sixth form, I think, is where I really flourished, because went to a different school again for sixth form, and that's where I've got my really good friendships from. Sport, took by that point, had slightly taken a back seat, but I got involved with the theatre, and putting on productions and stuff like that. And actually, there's a huge parallel in my life. So I did an English and theatre studies degree, and I'm very much of the view that sport is the great unwritten drama and the characters that are involved. And that's what I've always loved about sport. I'm not a stats person. The parallels between sport and drama and telling stories is probably, where I come from.
It's a nice way of putting it, actually, isn't it? Because you've been around some big events, and there's never a script, is there? It's just what happens, and it's freedom.
Yeah, and I think even when you kind of know what the outcome might be, take Grimsby recently, going, I mean, they're incredible and what they've done against Southampton, but you kind of knew it was likely to kind of hit the buffers at Brighton. But just the story of them getting to there is a fabulous story to tell. So I think, even if you can give you a 99% chance that you're going to be right on what the outcome is going to be, the story of the underdog getting there is almost better.
And that's what the FA Cup's all about, isn't it? In this country, it's about the Grimsby stories and Lincoln not long ago and things like that. So if we go back a little bit then to playing sport, and what about football and cricket tick the box for you?
I think they were the biggest sports. Where I'm from is around the corner from Lords. There's something about cricket I've always loved. I think it's the rhythm of it. It's quite a relaxing sport to sit and watch, not the T20 these days in the air, but it was very much more, test matches and stuff like that. And also, I loved scoring. The old fashioned scoring with all the little dots. I liked patterns. I think it was probably that. And I do like, I did do maths, but I think I was more of a pure mathematician than applied. I always found the applied side of it quite tricky, but I quite liked the patterns of pure maths. If it's a weird one. If you put it in front of me now, I couldn't do it at all. But and football was just, it is the big sport. So I think I just enjoyed kicking a football around. And actually, I think if you look at what were, when I was growing up, girls' sports and boys' sports, people didn't play netball in the playground at break. And the beauty of football is, you could literally put a couple of jumpers down. If somebody had a football, you could play. And cricket-wise, there was literally a piece of wood we used as a bat. And, you drew in chalk wickets on a wall and off you went. So I think, it was being able to play those things. Whereas, I say netball and stuff like that, and hockey, which was the other one. Yeah, you didn't play that at your break.
So you had chalk and we had broken flags, and that we had to stand up for wickets. So you had it the good way.
Oh, luxury.
So what was the options leaving school then? So what did you choose for GCSEs or whatever you chose, and where was that direction going to take you?
I did a right mix. I mean, I was arts and sciences, so I did all three sciences, did very well in them and probably should have gone with those, but didn't. I did English, geography and maths at A-level. Wasn't great at A-levels. Don't know why. Me and A-levels never got on because I got a 2-1 degree and was closer to a first than to a 2-2. So, you know, the brain was all right. There was just something about A-levels and whatever they wanted that I didn't quite get. But I was very lucky in that I go back to a time when it was, yes, they gave you an offer, but they'd interviewed you. So I clearly interviewed very well or well enough that even though I didn't get the grades, I got into Warwick University.
And how are you in that environment when you're under a bit of, because there is a bit of tension and stress there for the student side. So is that something you embrace, that pressure environment?
Well, I don't know what you mean by pressure of being a student. Exams or?
Not only exam, but you said back then they interviewed for places. So how do you feel the process of an interview? Was you good at that sort of thing?
I think probably if I went through a BBC interview now, I might struggle. You know, I think the ones where they're genuinely finding out about you, your love for what it is you're applying for, I did quite well. And I definitely clicked with the woman who did the interview, and she taught me Shakespeare. She taught me, you know, plays and stuff. I did English and theatre studies, so it was a very sort of, though it was not acting, it was very play driven as a course. And I clearly showed a passion for the course and what I liked about theatre.
Suppose, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it as well. It's you were selling yourself and what your interests were rather than trying to please them, wasn't you?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a tick box exercise. I think a lot of interviews now, I don't know about university interviews, obviously, but I think if you go for a job with HR and stuff like that, you've got to meet various criteria and it's got to be, there's a lot of ticking boxes, isn't there, and making sure it's a very fair process, which it has to be.
So talk to us about uni life and what comes along with uni life, as well as obviously freshers is a great chance to let the barriers down, though, isn't it? I know we've just associated that with the drink a little bit, haven't we, and excessive food and partying, but it's a chance to open yourself up socially, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a chance to grow up as well, university, isn't it? And you know, leave home. And I think sort of find yourself. I mean, one of the things I found was the university radio. Warwick University's, I mean, Simon Mayo's an ex-graduate of Warwick radio station. And I did a Saturday afternoon show doing the sport. But that was a lovely, you know, it's like-minded people. There's a guy called Phil Parry who works down at BBC London. He was the year above me. He was on there as well. It was lovely to see when the London Broncos came up. We did quite a lot of work with him. It was really lovely to meet up with him. Adam Mountford, who is the TMS producer these days, he was my year there as well. So, you know, work with him. And it was a really nice time, I think, in terms of just growing up and growing into who you wanted to be. It bought you time, and you know, you go back to my time, you didn't have to kind of mortgage your house to go to university. So it was, there wasn't the pressure on it. I think that there is these days for kids who are going to have this completely clear path of who you're going to be and what you're going to do and all of that, which I think is really difficult to answer at that stage in your life.
Yeah, there's a big decision to make whether you're willing to put yourself in that type of debt, isn't there? Whether it's available to you, some, like we said about boundaries of standards of living. Some kids are really bright, they just can't afford to go, and the ones that can't afford to go maybe haven't quite got the academic skills to get there, but hopefully it all evens itself out. But when you said it was a really nice time on the uni radio, was it due to freedom? Was you allowed to just be yourselves behind the microphone?
I think it was just, so, you know, the odd thing is my career has pretty much been in television, but I listen to much more sport on the radio. I mean, I love Test Match Special. So, you know, to be on the radio felt like I was doing what I'd listened to for all those years. And I think it was just like-minded people who, you know, in our case, you know, all love sport, but also loved the medium of radio. I covered the funeral of Fred Truman, you know, absolute Yorkshire legend, and I've met him, but I've never seen him play in the flesh. I've seen, you know, what he could do. But for me, he was a voice on Test Match Special. He was the grumpy Yorkshireman on Test Match Special. And, you know, I reflected that in the piece we did because the late, great Christopher Martin Jenkins had come up to the funeral as well up in Bolton Abbey. And it was, you know, that Test Match Special was very, very part of my life. It was like a companion that came along with you. So to find myself doing sport on the radio was just a lovely thing, really.
Yeah. And did your degree give you the insight of what can go on behind a production as much as what goes on to the eye of a production?
It was much more studying the plays. It's quite an academic course. It wasn't drama as such, it was studying the plays. I am incredibly well read, but I can't actually remember any of them. Which sounds absolutely dreadful, but you know, if you give it to me, I'll work it out, you know. But in terms of, they all slightly merged, particularly all of the kind of, you know, Shakespeare into Shakespeare, not so much, but the Websters and stuff like that. There was an awful lot of that that did, I'm not going to lie, just sort of slightly merge into one, that they all seem the same. But there was a lot of, you know, what the stage directions are, why they were happening. But I don't think that translates into what I did later on. It was just, I had a love for the theatre, which I'd grown up with a bit.
Right. So what is the next step for a young Tanya then, once you've graduated and the big wide world has got its arms open for you?
I didn't have a clue.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, we sort of sat there and I thought of doing a master's just literally to buy me time because I really didn't know. It was my mum that suggested I did a 1-year postgrad in broadcast journalism, which, again, you know, you didn't have to mortgage your life to do these things then. So I went to City University, got in, went to City University and did a 1-year postgrad in, which, you know, gives you the qualification. You do a bit of law in there as well. And that's the thing that set me on the path of what my career would become.
Right. And what would that entail? You're going out and seeking voluntary work, so for experience?
I did work experience in down in Kent at the Independent Station, at Wiltshire Sound. I learned about the magic roundabout in Swindon, because that's what they do to all the work experience people who go to work at Wiltshire Sound. They send them out to go around the magic roundabout and go, oh my God, who on earth created this? And then they hope they come back alive, having gone around the magic roundabout. If you've never done it, it's worth going just to go, who the heck created this and what were they on? So I did work experience there, and I did work experience at Breakfast News, which was incredible, and did overnights, which is also a fairly mind-boggling experience. It's not something I'm glad to say I've done again, that full overnight. My word, that was tough. But Breakfast News was a real eye-opener for me in terms of what goes on.
And did you know what sort of avenue you were going to go down during your course? Did you start to decipher what ticked the box for you and what didn't? Or was it always going to be sport?
It wasn't ever going to be sport, though I did do sports. You know, there was a sort of sports module, which I did. I did a documentary on boxing, but women didn't do sport. And there is, you know, you're going back, 30 years. And Helen Rollison was about it. Ellie Oldroyd was coming through, but literally, you know, and it is, you know, you can't be what you can't see. I didn't join the dots up that I could be a sports reporter, and that's what I wanted to be. And I was a journalist, straight up and down journalist for 5 years before I did sport.
Putting into words how frustrating that must be when it's right there, but society's not quite ready.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, I'm glad to say it's changed massively. And, you know, having left and having had somebody who's under 35 talk about me in front of the rest of the team as someone who helped break the glass ceiling and be a pioneer is something I'm really, really proud of looking back. I don't think I realised it at the time because, you have your head down doing the job. But, the 5 years doing straight news was really good grounding for me as well. And I don't think, you know, necessarily to do sports news, you have to just do sport. I mean, I actually think, you know, being an actual journalist and doing a court case and doing this, that and the others is a really good grounding for you as well.
Yeah, and in that 5 years, was anything ever overwhelming? Did you ever doubt what you wanted to go on to achieve?
Yeah, no, I had 6 months. So I got in on a traineeship. So when I was doing the 1 year postgrad, BBC Yorkshire, so the four radio stations, and the year that I got in, Cumbria and Carlisle, did a kind of traineeship. And they went around the courses, media courses, as you see them today, didn't exist. There was literally these six unis that did the 1 year postgrad. And they went around each of them. I think they took about five from each course and took us up for what was a fun day in theory, which was basically the selection process. But ironically, the first thing that they gave us was a quiz to do. And the first question on this quiz was which city's got two teams in the FA Cup semi-final? And it was the year United and Wednesday were playing each other. So I put down Sheffield, but in brackets, put down London as well, because it was also Arsenal-Tottenham in the other semi-final. So I knew, obviously, because they were BBC Yorkshire, that was what they wanted, but the guy who didn't know his sport. And because my surname is Arnold, I was first up in the interview so I could explain it. So I think immediately you've gone, oh, she knows a bit, she's a bit different. So that got me through the first process. And the second process was one of those horrible group things where you're supposed to shine but be part of a team with a bunch of people you don't know and all of that malarkey. At lunchtime, they sent half of them home. And I was still standing. And again, you know, bits of sport had come out and my interest in sport had come out. Again, they'd given us a quiz and I think, I got all the sports questions right. And I was given a job by BBC Radio Leeds initially. Did news. It was the days of tape as well and razor blades of making a package. So my God, it was slow. Went learning how to do it. And then they put me on the breakfast show after a couple of months. Doing what was a news and sport mixed shift, which was pretty much my introduction to rugby league because it was the days everybody played on a Sunday. So the Monday morning was rugby league results. And the presenter of said Radio Leeds breakfast show was one Dave Woods. So we go right to the beginning for me.
So is it nice to go through the levels and statuses along with these people that you're naming? So you're seeing each other's journey, which must be really pleasant, the growth that you have had and similar paths.
Yeah, I mean, Dave has been a constant through my life and he's the one that taught me that it's Castleford and not Castleford. Yeah. So that bulletin that I did at 6 o'clock on a Monday morning, I got back downstairs. For some reason, I was in a little studio on my own upstairs and the programme came from a big studio downstairs. And he said, you did very well. But if you say Castleford on my program again, I'm taking you off air. It's Castleford. And for that matter, it's Doncaster. And by the time I went home for Christmas and my dad said, would you like a drink? And I said, yeah, I'll have a glass of wine. And he just looked at me and I said, yeah, who are you? Look on his face. You'll be going for a bath next. Yeah. Woodsy. He's been an ever constant through my life. And obviously spend a lot of time introducing him or him popping up on programs that I present. He's been a real constant. And actually Damian Johnson is the other one, because I've worked alongside him at Look North and then replaced him as the sports reporter at Look North, and obviously now we do the rugby league together. So they're two people who have been real constants. But one of the lovely things about Look North has been that there was a team of us who really did grow up together, and for sort of 15 years it felt like nobody ever left. And then a lot of us, you know, over the last couple of years have gone. And I think there's a real, you know, and it needs to happen. You know, you need fresh blood in there. But it was lovely. You know, there really is a family of people that I've kind of grown up with.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a transition for you as well in a similar time frame as well.
Yeah, in the last couple of years, a lot of us have moved for different reasons. You know, there was a big round of voluntary redundancies a couple of years ago, which a lot of people took and then a few of us have gone around this time. Just just complete coincidence this time around, because none of us got VR, but you know, just time to move on.
Yeah. And is it an industry where people genuinely help each other, or is it very cutthroat like us viewers and listeners think it is?
Bit of both. Right. You know, I think you get a lot of people who do and you get some people who don't. You know, I think that in that regard, like any industry, I'd like to think I've helped quite a few people, particularly latterly, mentored a fair few people at Look North, and actually, to a certain extent, taken more pleasure and pride out of that than I have necessarily in doing the job, because it's just lovely to see somebody flourish. And the person who's replaced me at Look North is somebody who I mentor. You'd have to ask her whether she thinks of me as a mentor. I've certainly pushed her quite a lot. I think there are some people, and I think it's changing, but there was a point where I think particularly women didn't necessarily help women. There was a feeling threatened when they got up there, they felt threatened by the next one coming along, which I think is very sad. But I mean, I've always got on with my opposite numbers at Calendar. They've been good friends. Yeah, we're competitors, but not, you know, nobody lives and dies by it. It's, particularly with live telly, you're on again tomorrow. So, what's the point of trying to stitch somebody up? It's never been my thing. But yeah, of course, there are people who do, and there are people who don't. It's one of those industries, I think.
You'd have thought with the journey you've been on, where it's took you a long time to, like you said it yourself, break the ceiling. You think, could you see a lot of let's empower each other with women, don't you? And you think that would be the case in front and behind the camera, but obviously you said that a threat to some people is very personal, isn't it? And nothing really should be took personal sometimes.
I think for some, the battle to get there was really, really tough. So, they're very wary, apart from anything. I hope it's changing. I don't think it's changed enough yet in terms of the abuse that we get as women. But, at least now there's people to talk to about it. I mean, when I look back at my early days, and that's been one of the really interesting things of talking to business people, particularly the women, of their early days in business and in finance, it's a very similar tale of being lonely. And you don't realize it at the time because you got your head down just trying to do the job and trying to prove to myself I could do the job, let alone to everybody else that I could do it. But I look back and think, my God, it was lonely. And I'm lucky that my now husband worked in sports. So at least he understood what it was I was doing, but he didn't understand being the only woman in the room the whole time. And, what it was like when I went back to work with my kid. He did, but just the emotions of it and the all of that. It was a lonely time to be the only woman in the room the whole time was tough.
Yeah. And the mental health thing wasn't really... It was the old man up phrase, wasn't it? It regardless of your gender, it was just toughen up and crack on. There was no one you could go in, genuinely speak to, whether it was neutral or company related, was there?
No, and I, it was actually quite a male newsroom as well at the time. And I don't think they had any concept of what they were asking me to do. I look back and was the person who gave me the job pioneering. Certainly in Look North, no, he literally had no opportunity. Who I was up against, I was very clearly the best candidate. Did he think, fantastic, look what we're doing, we're promoting a woman? Nope. Was he comfortable with it? Don't think so. Did he support me through it? Absolutely not. But then I'm not sure he understood what it was he was putting me into. So, I would hope the environment now is a lot more supportive.
Hopefully to them types of people you've justified it, because you've earned the right to climb the ladder and do what you want to do now, because you've done the hard stuff, haven't you? You've gone through them hard times, dark times, lonely times to be
generous. I heard a young lass stand up in front of people saying, oh, it's hard, so hard getting a break as a woman doing this, and you're just like, nah, not now it really isn't. For me, and there was somebody who was listening online and somebody else who was alongside me who were a few years younger than me, but not many. It was bloody hard when we came through. But now, if you are good enough as a woman, you are very much pushing at an open door. And of that, I'm really, really proud to have been a part of opening that door. And there's no doubt that I was, because literally I didn't see another woman for years doing my job. There was Louise Taylor, who was worked in the newspapers, sometimes around the football. But broadcast wise, there really wasn't at all. So, I wouldn't take any truck now with young girls saying, oh, because I'm a woman, I can't get in, that's absolute nonsense now. For a whole raft of us, it was bloody hard.
Yeah, it was extremely difficult. So when did covering Leeds United become that? That was it a main body of work for you, or was it?
Yeah,
was it
like so the first my first work? Day in the job as sports reporter for Look North, I flew to Rome with Leeds United in the what's now the Europa League. So I did the climb into the Champions League. Did the Champions League, was missed the Valencia semi-final because I was very, very pregnant by that point. Came back, and then we did the slide back down. So though I've always done all sport, so by no means was I only Leeds United, but they were very much the dominant team, obviously, at that time. And it was an incredibly good time, and then it was an incredibly bad time. I remember my son was a toddler, taking him to a park, and he was playing, and we went to buy an ice cream, and the bloke at the ice cream van pointed at me and went, "You're the woman that stands outside Elland Road." I just thought, yeah, I've done a lot of that in the last few months. And I was there the whole bloody time. And I learned about administrations with a few of our football clubs, not just Leeds United. It was a time when some of my best contacts were administrators. They were giddy days. Traveling Europe was an amazing experience. Damn sight easier these days when everything's digital to do the job than it was back then. Leeds United was a big, big story for certainly the early few years of my career.
How is it riding the highs with the lows of club sport? Is it easy to put that across, Tanya? Because there'll be some people that only remember Leeds being good, and there'll be some people that remember Leeds, without being rude to Leeds, I'm a United fan, so they won't like hearing it, but it's like they yo-yo for a bit, didn't they?
They didn't yo-yo, they just plummeted and couldn't get back up. It was, you weren't really talking for a while, for quite a long time, about what was going on the pitch. It was all money and the various weird and wonderful owners that they had, because it was the golden ticket. If you could get Leeds United back into the top flight, you know, they are a huge club. Because they're a one-club city. They've got a world, you don't have to build them as a worldwide brand. They are a worldwide brand. So that if you could be the one to get them up, you had a very, very good chance of actually making a fair amount of money, which is why they attracted some fairly interesting owners.
Yeah. How is it building relationships and connections when it comes to stories and knowing that they're reliable enough to revisit? Is that a difficult task and something you've got better at as you've become more established and experienced?
I think around those times, there were various people that I never got anywhere near Chiellino. I was a woman. There was a bizarre press conference when Adam Pearson was briefly back at Leeds United. And he went back as a consultant or something. And Chiellino was just on one. But he was answering, he was all over the place, but I asked him a question and he just batted me away with his hand. And Adam, because I went way, way back with Adam, just looked at the floor. He was so embarrassed. So Chiellino, just forget it. There was no point. Ken Bates, I was never getting anywhere near him. As a woman, it's an interesting one. You know, the relationship, it's changing. But the relationship then was, we had Peter Reid as manager, and a few of the boys would go drinking with him. I was never going to join in that. I was never going to be a part of that. But interestingly, years later, sat next to him at a dinner. I went, "Oh, I don't know if you remember." He said, "Of course I remember you." So, yeah, I stood out from the crowd, but I wasn't part of, I wouldn't have gone drinking with him and stuff like that. So it's a very, it's different now. I think you don't really get very close to certainly the top flight of managers and stuff like that. They very much are. And that's one of the sad things, I think, about football. You know, as you go up it, it's very, very distant, and you don't really have those relationships with people. But I think my relationships were different, but I think I was always, I wasn't afraid to ask the question. If a difficult question needed asking, I would ask it. And I think that earned a lot of people's respect. And it earned the respect of some of the journalists around me, which was also important. I was really lucky with the crowd that followed Leeds United. They were a really, really good bunch. And they kind of looked after me. And I had Ian Dennis as well, which you couldn't ask for any more than Denno.
Right. And it probably kept it at arm's length without knowing as well, didn't it? If you were willing to go in and meet fire with your questions and answers, they were probably well aware of looking around you rather than at you for questions, weren't they?
No, I never had that.
You were all right.
You know, yeah. No, I mean, you know, I think certainly, you know, Yorkshire Cricket, the guy that used to run Yorkshire Cricket, you know, he's always said, you know, if there was a tough question to ask, you'd be the first one to put your hand up. And I had huge respect for that. Somebody's got to ask the question. They know it's coming. So, you know, somebody's got to ask it. And I don't have respect for journalists who will just ride on the coattails of the ones that will ask it. You know, and I do know some of them, you know, you know, the question's got to be asked, have the balls to answer it, ask it, quite frankly. Why do I have to do it every time? Yeah.
Yeah. No, and I suppose that's why you got into the game, though, wasn't it? To put yourself forward and to get that info for people and for yourself, because you're into sport yourself. We all want to know, like, the intricacies and dark arts of certain things. It's just, like you said, whether you've got to ask it, isn't it?
I just think you've got to do your job. You know, I mean, I've got, you know, I didn't take any pleasure in, you know, I don't take any pleasure in the difficult stories, the tough stories to tell, but it doesn't mean they haven't got to be told. That's the job. You have the glory times, but you also have the tough times as well. And yeah, I'm first and foremost, I'm a journalist. You know, that's my job. Yeah. That's my training. And your job is to tell the story as it is, I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the better the standard, the least contact and sort of outreach there is. So when you go to them lower leagues, and sometimes it might have been non-league and stuff, are they some of the most enjoyable places you've been?
Yeah, and there's, you know, actually the club that I think was one of my favourite to deal with, actually, because they didn't push us away as they got higher up, was Sheffield United. And when Sheffield United were in the Premier League, they included the local media. I completely understand for the clubs, you know, the higher up you go, the demands, particularly television demands with the rights holders, are immense. And they have to do open training on X, Y, and Z. And we're not rights holders. When you come down to local level, you're not a rights holder. But they made sure that we had the same access because we've been there all the way. And I think one of the most impressive things I've seen from a football club that is, you know, on the up was when Sheffield United got promoted. If you remember, it was a game they weren't playing and it was looking at somebody else's result. And they invited everyone along, all the players and the manager were watching, and said, look, if they make it up, fill your boots. If they don't, none of this ever sees the light of day. And that's, you've got to have a really strong relationship with all the people and all the organizations to have the trust in them. And it is a trust that goes both ways. But I just thought that was a really, really impressive way to treat the media. It's a very grown-up way of treating the media. Thankfully, it did work. And you know, the footage was absolutely incredible. But, you know, Sheffield United were really, their press officer, fantastic to deal with. Actually, oddly, a couple of the lower division clubs currently are bloody difficult. I won't go name names. You know, it has changed. Football has changed, I think, quite a lot. It's got a lot more distant. It's maybe one of the reasons I love dealing with the rugby league. It's so open and so friendly, and the access you get to players is incredible, and coaches. So I think, yeah, I think maybe that's one of the reasons I love the sport as much as what goes on the pitch.
Well, to be honest, you've led us on nicely there. So is that how rugby league has sort of stepped forward for you, because of how open and welcome it is? And the fan base, I imagine, aren't quite as brutal as other fan bases. And there is a real acceptance there to grow the sport, regardless of gender, ability, because the PDRL's kicking off properly, isn't it? The LDRL's kicking off properly. The women's game's growing. So what is it about rugby league that you thought it's a bit of me when you first went or first covered?
I think there was an element of, you know, if you're in Yorkshire and doing sport, you've got to get your head around rugby league. But it was incredibly welcoming, even though I clearly wasn't, you know, an expert on it or anything like that. And I'm probably not anymore, not now, but I know a bit more now than I did then. Brian Noble's probably the most interesting one for me, because he really has known me all the way through. In terms of, he was assistant coach, then he was coach at Bradford Bulls. So yeah, they were the kind of most successful in the early part of my career. I always say Nobby knows exactly how much I don't know about rugby league. And then obviously, you know, he's been a pundit on many a program that I've been on with him. But he was fab, you know, and Stuart Duffy, who was the press officer at the Bradford Bulls at the time, they were so helpful. And now, yeah, Phil Daly at Leeds Rhinos has been incredible. That, yeah, those were the two real success stories in the day job that I dealt with, in terms of, you know, the Bulls were winning everything and turning around rugby league in the early days, and then kind of the Rhinos took over. And yeah, those two press officers were just brilliant at what they did in the case of Stuart. But all of them, you know, all the clubs have been phenomenally welcoming. I've only had a couple of times when, you know, as you, I felt like, you're a woman, what the hell? Again, I won't name names, but one quite famous person who, I wonder if I told him that now, what he'd think. It would be a really interesting one. But yeah, the sport has been amazing for me. And yeah, for somebody who came from North London, to have found such a home with rugby league is credit to the sport more than it is to me, I think, that it is welcoming. I remember when Claire was doing it, you know, I mean, she just absolutely loved, and so does Chappers. Yeah, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say, you know, he probably doesn't need to do rugby league. He loves doing rugby league. And we just love what we're doing when we're doing, working on rugby league. It's just a fantastic team of people to work with. And yeah, it's been a very, very special sport for me.
Yeah. And what sort of things is it that you'd enjoy behind the scenes? Obviously, recently, this weekend, you showed swapping your jacket over and stuff. But that's the thing we don't see, isn't it? Everything looks like it's hunky-dory. You're warm, you're fed. You've got comfy, the posh seats.
We're not.
That's what everyone
we're
thinks, don't
not
they?
Warm. Oh, it's bloody cold at Salford. I got it completely wrong, clothing-wise. We're not fed. We are sometimes, but not normally. If you're pitch side and it's raining, if you're pitch side reporter and it's raining, you're getting wet. It's not a glamorous job. I think people think it's a very glamorous job, and it definitely isn't. The coat change, I'm waiting to see the edit. Of that, it's for literally one line in the program, and I'd like to say that I've had the snow leopard coat for quite a long time. I've put proof of it up from 2019 in the London Broncos, but I think people can guess what the club might be that we're talking about. But yeah, I mean, what I love most, again, it's the team. So my producer John Harrison, we've done the show together since I took over in 2012, and he's brilliant. It's his program, really. It's my job to make his hard work on screen. But I'd like to think we're a pretty impressive partnership in terms of, you know, I trust him implicitly. We generally have the same one of the, we tend to have a guy called Rob who is the main cameraman. Now we're out on the road. And then there's two or three others who are the second crew. And it's fun. And the players, you know, we get incredible guests. You come along, they're not getting paid a fortune. Spend the afternoon with you and you get to chat to them, you know, while the game's going on. And, you know, to watch a game with players or coaches is absolutely fascinating. I mean, watching a game with John Keir he's still like a child. His excitement. When we were in COVID and we took him, I can't remember, were we at St. Helens? So we were two or three weeks into it. And he hadn't been, you know, he hadn't seen a game. And it was like, you know, taking a kid who hadn't been allowed sweets for 6 months into a candy store. He was just so excitable. And it's just infectious, that. But, you know, it's very much, and, you know, when you go up to the Challenge Cup and the World Cup and stuff, you know, we're not the biggest team, but it's a really close-knit team of people who love the sport. And that's the thing that's fantastic. It's the team of people. And I think when you're presenting at the World Cup, the Challenge Cup or whatever, you are purely, you know, I very much feel the responsibility of delivering all the work that they've put in, because the people who are working behind the scenes have put an awful lot more in than me or Chappers rocking up on the day to deliver it. And you want to do your best for them and for all the work that they've put in.
So I'm sure you don't get fed because you it's so much.
You get
silly,
the challenge cup. So the challenge cup, we get sandwiches. So we literally have a little picnic, a little bag. So I've gone to the nearest shop and you get a sandwich, a packet of crisps, and a chocolate bar, and that's it.
Little meal deal.
Yeah. I mean, they've come out with a bag full of sandwiches. If you're in the studio, I've never quite understood this because we're getting wet and cold down pitch side and we get nothing. If you're in the studio, they have a kettle and they tend to have fruit and biscuits that they bring out. So if the studio crew get looked after, the pundits basically get looked after much, much better than the rest of us. But no, we're not having, we don't. The only time we've had food trucks is when you've got double headers and stuff like that, because you have to give people a hot meal. During the World Cup, obviously, we had a fair few of those. So then we got really, that was nice. We got proper food and that was good. But no. And on the Super League show, nothing. Nada.
Yeah.
John might go and get us a cup of tea.
I'll give you the receipt for a little hint for the money back.
No, don't, not allowed to claim that, apparently. Now I'm freelance.
So do you know what's mad, though? For the end product of what the Super League show gives you, for you to be such a small team, the product is unreal, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I mean, I think people, it's really easy for people to throw stones at what happens. But if you looked at the budget for the Super League show, I mean, television is not cheap. And that's one of the things, you know, I think people don't really understand the production costs behind it. It's now we're on the road. It's two crews, John and then the editor. Back at base, I think they have somebody who helps with graphics, and there's another producer who may chip in to do some of the match edits, and then Woodsy, Matt, Sharon do comms sometimes in the building, sometimes they're literally sent the tape and they're doing them from there. It is an incredibly tight team, and actually if you look at the production standards on the Super League show, PDI are the team that make it, but John is very much, it's very much his program. I think what he does with it is mighty, mighty impressive.
Yeah. And how did the reach out to you come about to take over? And was it something you had to think twice about?
It wasn't something I thought twice about. So because it's made by an indie, it has to go out to tender at certain points. And it went out to tender 12 years. I'd asked the BBC about presenting it in locally, because it's one of these weird, it's a mixture of regional and it's a bit of a mess, to be quite frankly, in terms of the governance of it. I don't way above my head and my pay grade, but I'd asked regionally about it and they'd said no, you know, they were happy with Harry doing it. So, you know, I was, by this point I was working on the Challenge Cup and stuff, but when it went out to tender, as I understand it, various companies put me down as presenter. PDI being one of them, they got the tender. It still had to go through Skid because it's the BBC that chooses who the presenter is, not the indie. So they can suggest it as part of their pitch and part of what they want to do with the program. That's how I ended up getting it. But it wasn't me interviewing or something like that. But Carl Hicks was the head of Rugby League at the time. And he, because I was part of his team, he wanted me on it so that, you know, you've got that BBC look about it, so that, because if you had somebody who had nothing to do with the BBC's national coverage doing it now, I think it would look a bit odd, given it's the kind of weekly staple for rugby league. So I got it in 2012 with John, and we're a bit like Thelma and Louise. I think one day we'll go off a cliff together, possibly not in a nice car, but you know. John, I think he probably in the early days wondered what the hell he'd been landed with, We're very close now. And I did text him the other day because, you know, I'm not going to say that the last 6 weeks, couple of months haven't been very odd for me in terms of throwing my life up in the air. And I did send him a message saying we I think it was after Castleford, and we just had a great afternoon. It was really good fun. It went really well. I said, really enjoyed today. Not for the first time in our working relationship, you're keeping me sane. And he has a wry smile. I could see the wry smile as he read it.
So do you feel the Challenge Cup has a place in the calendar as much as like the FA Cup does? Have you felt the magic around the Challenge Cup when you've done it?
I haven't. I think sometimes it's unloved by the powers that be. I think when you're sticking something on terrestrial telly, you want the stadiums to be full. You know, I understand you can't necessarily fill Wembley up or whatever, but, you know, you want the product to have that. I still have, I was there when Bradford beat Leeds a few years ago. You don't get the upsets you get in football because it's that much harder in rugby league. But, you know, that was Keary working his magic once again. And, you know, Leeds were not in a good place at the time. And, you know, that was just, you know, the buzz around that was absolutely fantastic. I have to say, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed the Challenge Cup final at Spurs last year. And it was a, you know, really tense game. Obviously went right to the very end. I thought the Spurs was just a fantastic stadium to be in. So, yeah, I'm absolutely. I hope as we are reimagining the game, they reimagine how important the Challenge Cup is. And that's not to do down anybody else's coverage. But, you know, if you look at the numbers that we get for the Challenge Cup, it's big numbers. But you do, you know, I think to, you know, and it's women's football has grown and grown. As you've seen stadia full, you get that buzz, you get that atmosphere. If there's two men and a dog in the stadium, it's quite hard to sell the product because it hasn't got that atmosphere around it and that excitement.
Must admit, I went to when we played Samoa in the semi-final at the Emirates with the girlfriends. Doesn't know a lot about rugby, but she looked around and she couldn't understand why the top half of the stadium was virtually empty. But then when you watched it back on telly, you can see that. Like, why not compress and just put, like, some form of banner in, or, you know, all the club size, even the amateur teams, just a little something on them seats that if the camera does have to pan up, say, off a kick or something, that there's exposure there for clubs, isn't there? But I agree with you. You want them big games, maybe in smaller stadia, just to be full, so you can feel that buzz, don't you?
Maybe you just want them to be full, actually.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Shouldn't you aim up rather than aim down, if that makes sense?
100%, yeah. And it comes from asking people to pay silly money for tickets, I suppose, doesn't it? And if you're going to have it in London, make it so it's easy to get there, and because of everything that was going on at the time.
I felt for the World Cup because obviously it should have been a year earlier when I think, you know, we were all in a very, very different place. You know, I know people who bought their tickets very, very early for it, who had the most incredible time very, very cheaply. I'm sure lessons are being learned from that. But I do think, you know, I have huge sympathy with what they had to deal with by postponing it for a year. And also, you know, when it was a year earlier, we were the only show in town. You'd already had so many big sporting events in the country that it didn't quite have, you know, the same place it would have had a year before. So I think, I thought John Dutton and his team did a pretty remarkable job when you look at what they had to unknit, then put back together, and then find themselves in a very, very different financial climate. So I think, and a very different sporting climate. So, I have quite a lot of sympathy, I have to say, with what they had to deal with. I'm sure lessons are being learned, have been learned from it. But I think sometimes, rugby league fans actually need to look at themselves a little bit. They moan a lot, they have a go at a lot of other people, but don't necessarily, you know, rock up themselves or make the effort to book the tickets early or whatever when they could have been cheaper. They like to have a bit of a go sometimes.
Saying I enjoyed the occasion. I think the ground was brilliant. I thought the game lived up to what it should have been.
Oh, if only they could have won.
Especially after the first one, you know, when we battered Samoa. I think it very much lived up to it. But I tend to agree, we always look at someone else for the blame, I suppose, in this sport, don't we?
I do think there is an element of that. You know, I kind of appreciate, you know, I appreciate, but there is, I think we have to try and be positive and try and big up the game and not, you know, I think sometimes the sport can be guilty of doing itself down. And it is a great sport, and I don't know. It's very difficult. Yeah, be careful what you dream of with wanting it to be like football. You're not going to have that kind of money in it. There's got to be a realism about what's going on. But people do. There's a lot of knocking going on without necessarily thinking sometimes.
Yeah. While you were doing the coverage on the radio and stuff with the BBC, was rugby union ever a potent threat to football and rugby league? Because I know Yorkshire Carnegie, or whatever they go by now, they've been very, you've talked about owners with Leeds United. I think they've been very similar with owners there, haven't they? I know Gary
when
had
you
a
say
little
a
to
threat,
do with
what do you mean as a threat?
Did it ever feel like they were gonna grow and be everything that Yorkshire tried for Leeds like to be or Carnegie to be?
I mean, we had them very successful winning a trophy at Twickenham, and it was just, you know, I don't look at sport, you know, I don't look at sports as threats to each other, if that makes sense. I do financially, I think football, you know, it just soaks so much of the money out of the broadcasting landscape, in that degree being a threat. But, you know, it's been sad. You know, I'm not one who says, you know, you've got to knock one sport to big up the other. I never quite understand why you have to say which one's better. You know, allow people to enjoy the sports for what they are. Enjoy, you know, if they enjoy that one more, great, get out and play sport. You know, Michael Checker, I asked Michael Checker that question when we did the interview with him about the World Cup. I said, you know, over here, there's a fair bit of hatred, and there was him going from one to the other. And he said, you know, I don't understand that. You know, don't you want kids playing sport? Just enjoy them for what they are. So I think, a threat. I'm not sure threat is the right word, but I think it's really sad that there is really no rugby union. I mean, there's no women's Super League either in Yorkshire. You know, the top women's football club is sort of top end of the championship, but not pushing to go up. I think that's really sad, because for girls, that means that there's not the opportunity. You know, there's quite a heavy Yorkshire presence in the women's team, but they've all had to leave at 16. And then, you know, same with rugby union. You know, if for a girl, you go to Sale, that's it. You know, for the guys, you know, you're either going to Newcastle or again across Sale, or you're heading south. And I think that's just sad. I think the opportunity, if that's what you want to play, you know, it'd be nice if it was there for you.
Yeah, no, that ideally you'd have a club in every hot spot, wouldn't you? That people have something to look forward to and want to represent.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know whether if you're sat in the middle of Leeds, because you've got Yorkshire Cricket, but that is the only one that is what it says on the tin, so to speak, the only, having covered Yorkshire sport, the antipathy between various bits of Yorkshire, kids, if I had to say, is fairly heavy duty. You know, a lot of the, you know, they don't like each other in various parts. So it's quite difficult to break that down, because you have got, you know, cricket, it is Yorkshire cricket. It's a county game. Therefore, it kind of works. Whereas for the rugby union, I get why they tried to do it, because they tried to be the rugby union club for Yorkshire. But then there's quite a decent one in Rotherham. There's one in Doncaster, Harrogate's got, you know, so, and they just didn't buy into it. So that didn't work either. But, you know, even if you'd gone as Leeds or whatever, it would have been good if, you know, to have a top flight rugby union club. It's only good for an area. You know, I think it's positives rather than looking at it negatively.
100%. So you've been involved in some big occasions in the sport, and you've met some great people. And what big occasions really stand out to you? And because it's the people that make the game, isn't it? The game don't make the people.
Yeah, it's funny. We did last year. We launched the Super League show. The first one was going out on the 14th of February. So we did a Valentine's sort of thing, and asked 11 of the 12 coaches, you know, what do you love about rugby league? And I think 10 of the 11 said the people. And I think that's one of the things, you know, we went up to Barrow last year for the Challenge Cup, and it was one of the most memorable days I've had doing the Challenge Cup. It was absolutely fantastic. I'd not been up there. I mean, it was a hell of a drive up. It's a beautiful drive to get there. The people were so welcoming, so pleased that we were there. It was a great game. It's a really, really good advert for the game. And yeah, it's one that sticks out in the memory. I'm not going to, yeah, it was lovely. Thoroughly enjoyed Spurs, thoroughly enjoyed the final. You know, but I think, you know, the ones that really stand out is often the people that you're around as much as it is, you know, the match or the stadium that you're in.
And you've talked about you've gone freelance, haven't you? And basically you're branching out into the world. So where are you hoping that takes, and is sport still going to be a big part of that?
I hope so. So obviously I'm still doing the bulk of the Super League show this year and involved with the Challenge Cup. Who knows what happens rugby league wise next year, because none of us do know. So I'd be really, really sad if I'm not doing rugby league next year. I'd like to do another Olympics. I've been very lucky. I've done a couple of Olympics with the BBC regional team, but I would like to go to another Olympics. Unlikely that that's with the BBC. That's probably with another broadcaster. But I also just wanted to do some stuff that was different. And the crossovers between sport and business and what they can learn from each other are huge. So working on a couple of pitches for presentations, sort of panels with businesses. And I had some really interesting conversations with people. Spoke to a woman last week who's just fantastic. I just thought, what a great woman. And, you know, one of the things I think the thing I love most probably about the job is interviewing people, letting them give their opinions and their stories. And the way that we do the Super League show, the way we do the Challenge Cup, you know, as the presenter, you're sort of the facilitator for the people who know better than you what's going on. So telling other people's stories, you know, and it doesn't really matter what field you're in. You know, an interview is an interview. In my view, I mean, I'm not going to do one about, you know, the economic situation or something like that, because unless it was for dummies, I'd be slightly out of my depth. But, you know, getting her to tell her story, which was an incredible one, but in business rather than sport, would be a privilege. So it's a bit of a blank sheet of paper, but it's really nice to be doing, you know, talking to totally different people and just having some new challenges. That's all it was about. It was not, I haven't thrown my toys out of the pram or anything like that at all. I'd given everything I could to the job at Look North, and it had given me so much in return. And it was just time, I think, for both of us to have something new. I think probably the sports reporter needed a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh approach to doing it. And I just needed something different to get my teeth stuck into.
Just a nice refresher.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
So it's mad, really, because I've just bypassed the Olympics on you, really. But do you know when you think back and the journey started, could you ever have imagined where the places it took you, the people you've seen, the arenas you've been to and the events you've been a part of? Like you said at the time, I imagine you're fully invested in what you're doing and you don't really get a moment to step back and go, wow, and look around. It's probably when people like me, my dear.
Well, no, it's
you
been
get the chance to have a little thing.
It's been stepping back. Yeah, you know, it's been stepping back from that role. But I'm hugely, hugely appreciative of what doing the job at Look North has given me, where it's taken me, what opportunities it's given me. Which is, you know, I'm certainly not going to be somebody who has a go about it at all, because I've been really, really fortunate. I mean, to be at London 2012, you know, I've been asked a couple of times, what's the highlight? And I love rugby league, as you know, but being at London 2012, I mean, the Olympics is just the pinnacle in my view. For me, I just absolutely love it. And to be at London 2012, see some of what I saw, be there on Super Saturday. I mean, Jess Ennis is somebody I'd followed all the way through. So to be there when, yeah, she won gold was just absolutely incredible. Nicola Adams, I wasn't there when she actually won it. It's a long story. So I wasn't in the arena when she won the gold. But yeah, it's just been, there's been some unbelievable moments. And then I got to go to Rio as well. So yeah, fantastic moments. And yeah, there's a question you're going to ask me later, which I can't answer. I think it's just going to be an interesting one, because I hadn't put two and two together. But yeah, I absolutely would never have dreamed I'd get to do some of the things I'd done.
Especially a home Olympics. What was the atmosphere like when you first rocked up there? And is there no expectation, because you don't know what you're going to get?
So when I went for the job interview, I didn't really kind of clock. By that point, I'd, you know, done a Challenge Cup, a couple of challenges. I was part of the network team doing that by that point. And they'd asked, you know, you go through the interview process and you know, clearly because I had that network experience, I'd done a Challenge Cup final. I think they talked about, you know, pull out a highlight or something like that. And I talked about the first Wembley final I'd done. And then got a phone call. I was on the train going home, got a phone call saying you've got the job. And I didn't realise how much I wanted it until they told me I got it. And it was just an incredible buzz. And you know, being a Londoner, I know people don't talk to each other on the tubes. You know, London, I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say London isn't the friendlier of cities. But you rocked up at the Olympic Park and the volunteers literally instantly, you thought this is going to work. They just set the tone of the whole thing, the volunteers, and people chatted to each other on the tubes and they go, oh, what have you seen? Yeah, where have you been? And all of the rest of it. Because you had to wear your passes the whole time. It was like part of your uniform. So people knew, you know, and they had the tickets around their necks or whatever. It was just an incredible 2.5 weeks or whatever. I was down 3 weeks, but I was down there. And something I will never, ever forget. The pride. I mean, that opening ceremony was so good as well. But I think just walking around the park with the volunteers, even though the public weren't in, you just got a sense that it was going to be brilliant.
I can't get a signal in the living room, but you're getting one on the tray. How's that happening? So, yeah, it has come to that chat where I'm going to ask you a few daft questions. So, did you get any pre-show superstitions? Was there any routine that you used to do? Or
No, I'm not a superstitious person. And currently, I'm getting quite forgetful. So, I rocked up at Salford minus like makeup and stuff like that and a hairbrush. No, I don't have pre-match superstitions.
Right. So, the toughest player you've watched play the game, and the definition of tough is very different for everybody.
Jamie Peacock. Jamie's just, yeah, having watched him through his career, that final, grand final, I think he probably did about 70 minutes. I have no idea how he was even stood up at the end. But obviously I've also worked with JP a lot to know him, you know, as a person. And he's one of those people that you just thought, if you were in a dressing room with Jamie Peacock and you had not given your all out there, I'm not sure you couldn't look him in the eye. Surely you just couldn't look him in the eye. He was one of those people that must have dragged people around him to be the very best that they could be. So I think JP, Rob Burrow would also be in that bracket in a very different way, just because, you know, just a little guy in a big man sport, and he never ever took a backward step. Incredible bloke to watch play the game. But if I had to pick one, it would probably be JP.
Yeah, genuinely, whether it's words or actions, JP, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, favorite ground you visited?
That's a really, really difficult one, because the big ones have an aura about them. And I say Spurs last year was absolutely fantastic. I'm not going to lie, I wouldn't really want to go to Oddsall much at the moment, but Oddsall back in the day when the Bradford Bulls were at their height, and you know, the great Peter Deacon done such an amazing job with Summer Rugby League, when that place was full, because it's the natural amphitheatre. I mean, it was an amazing place to watch rugby league. It's not now. I'm not going to dress it up as that, but what an incredible amphitheatre that was. But then, you know, you flip to football, and I've been to some fairly amazing football grounds as well, dotting around Europe. So, you know, I've been very, very lucky in that regard. So I'm not sure I have an absolute favourite, if I'm going to be honest, but I say some of the days at Oddsall when it was in its heyday.
Like Bulls Mania.
Yeah, well, it was incredible. It really was incredible, because it just took off in a way that I think, you know, I say Peter Deacon had clocked what was going on, and he did an incredible job in creating something very, very special at that time.
Yeah. So, say you've had a few glasses of wine and you're out with family, friends, and the microphone's in your hand, what are you going to give us?
Not a hope in hell. One of the problems I've got with singing is I have quite a deep voice for a woman, so I can never find the pitch to sing a song. We once did for Comic Relief, Spice Girls. There was like five of us at work, and obviously I was Sporty Spice, which was really bad news, because Sporty Spice was the one that could sing. And I might be able to sing. I just can't find the pitch. And trying to sing with four other women couldn't find a pitch at all that we could all sing at. So that's where my problem lies. I'll sing along in a car, but it's my idea of absolute hell, I think, getting up and singing a song in karaoke and stuff, because I just can't find the pitch. And if I start too high or too low, I'm knackered.
I can't carry a tune in a bucket, me.
I might be able to if I could find what pitch I'm meant to start at.
So what would you tell a younger you if you could go back and give a bit of advice now?
See, this was the one I've been mulling over because, I never joined the dots up with the love of sport and what I've ended up doing. I think that's a really difficult question for me, in that I didn't fall into it. You know, when Damien was the sports reporter, I helped him out and I worked alongside him a bit, and then the job became free and I got it. But as I was coming through and as I was a kid, I just loved sport. But I didn't think, you know, I could have a job in it because, as we've talked about, you've got to see it to know you can do it. So I think it's really difficult. I think I'd just say it's going to be all right. Yeah, don't worry. It'll be all right.
Suppose if you told yourself something, you might not be where you are now. That's the other way of looking at it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it took me a little while to kind of grow into me, if that makes sense. But once it did, I think there's an element of trust yourself, of learning. I had to persuade myself as much as I had to persuade anybody else that I could do the job. When it came to doing sports. So I think probably I'd literally just say, don't worry, it'll be okay.
Oh, God.
You've been listening to Trot the Egging. Thanks to our sponsors, Bardell Sports. Follow us on Twitter @TrotTheEgging and Instagram @Trot_the_egg_in.